Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Rodimus versus the Indiana Housing Finance Authority. Mr. Wertheimer?
I'm here on behalf of Mr. Bradimus, who is a managing member or partner in the seven entities which are from northern Indiana. They're all low housing developments. Three of them are in St. Joseph County, three of them in Elkhart County, one of them in Marshall County. Basically, Mr. Bradimus obtained approvals from the county commissioners of St. Joseph and Elkhart counties, as well as the Common Council of Marshall County, for an acquisition and major rehabilitation of these multi-unit low-income properties. In connection with that, he had to do certain things with the Indiana Housing Finance Authority, make an application for tax credits, because in all of these low-income developments, the benefit to the developer is that tax credits are created and they are sold on the market for usually 75% to 80% of the tax credits, which the investors take over a 10-year period as tax credits. Now, this case was filed in June of 2000 in the U.S. District Court in South Bend, later transferred to Indianapolis. And we're here now because on behalf of the plaintiffs, I filed a motion for partial summary judgment as the liability only. In response, the primary defenses raised by, we say, IFA, is that the claims are barred by the statute of limitations. And the district court ruled that the cause of action to file suit to challenge the denial of these tax credits on the part of IFA accrued on June 17, 1997. The district court found that the plaintiffs are not entitled to equitable estoppel or equitable tolling concerning the statute of limitations and declined to rule on whether tax credits constitute a protected property right or interest. Now, one must understand that the denial of tax credit benefits arose out of a totally separate development, Madison Center in South, yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Madison Center in South Bend, apartment 102. A gentleman residing there by the name of Michael Himes received since 1987 and was an occupant since 1987 of Social Security disability benefits. He never earned enough income to file tax returns, and he was an ongoing resident. Nonetheless, IFA conducted an audit of apartment 102 in the Madison Center South Bend apartments and required Mr. Bradimus to assemble voluminous records, even though it had been earlier determined that Madison Center was in compliance by various agencies and successors. Mr. Bradimus did that. Now, what is critical in this case is that IFA issued an 8832 report to Internal Revenue Code in 1997 that Madison Center was not in compliance. Under the qualified allocation plan, IFA took the position that since Madison Center is not in compliance, all other projects you're working on are tainted, therefore we're not going to allow tax credits for these other developments. Meanwhile, Mr. Bradimus, as time went on, entered into a contract with Paramount. Now, Paramount was going to be the investor, the purchaser of these tax credits, totaling about $5.6 million. We, of course, didn't get to the issue of damages. It was liability only on the summary judgment motion. But in any event, what happened was when that 8823 was sent to the Internal Revenue Code, we're talking about 1997. Judge McKinney determined that's when the cause of action accrued. Now, on the issues of equitable estoppel and equitable tolling, I respectfully submit to you that Mr. Bradimus acted totally reasonably under the circumstances. He sought a review of apartment 1.
When do you think he had to sue? If your equitable estoppel or equitable tolling arguments have merit, what was his deadline?
His deadline would have been in May or June of 1999. basically the accrual of a cause of action for a deprivation of a right. In this context, you must have a uniting of
No, we're talking about equitable estoppel and equitable tolling. The cause of action accrues, mm-hmm. and then it's delayed, it's postponed.
Correct.
So my question is, postponed till when?
Till the end of May of 1999 at the earliest.
Why? What happened in May?
The Paramount Group withdrew from the projects. They were not willing to invest.
No, that's not equitable estoppel and equitable tolling. Equitable estoppel and equitable tolling has to do with... Equitable estoppel would be, did IFA do something that dissuaded Brademas from suing within the statute of limitations? Equitable tolling would be, you know, did he need information or something that without which he couldn't be expected to sue? So my question is, at what point do you think, if either of those defenses is in play, at what point did Brademas have to sue?
The end of May 24th, 1999. I want to direct
and
your
attention. And why May 24th, 1999?
That's when the Paramount Group withdrew from
what
the...
What does that have to do with equitable estoppel or equitable tolling?
That's a fair question. Let me answer it this way. Mr. Brademas requested an internal review of IFA of Apartment 102, Mr. Hines. IFA agreed to do that review. And I reference you to 42A of the appendix.
Right, and we know that they agreed to do the review, but it's not a situation where they said, we're going to review it and we promise you this is going to come out the way you want it. I mean, they weren't misled or anything. They just said, yes, we're going to review it. And that's the problem for you, because the fact that they made that review process available to him or acknowledged that he could do it, that doesn't help you, I don't think, on your equitable tolling or estoppel argument. They weren't misled. In other words, they didn't promise, we're going to do the review and so you'll get the relief you want, so don't sue. Hold off. Don't sue because we're going to do this review process. Then you'd fall into equitable estoppel, I think.
But you don't need, if I might reference Smith versus City of Chicago Heights, a case cited in this court, or ruled on this court in 1992, it is not necessary that the defendant intentionally mislead or deceive the plaintiff or even intend by its conduct to induce delay. The point is that Mr. Brademas could reasonably rely...
No, but look, the problem is, I think your position is anytime someone requests reconsideration, if he's not turned down immediately, that tolls the statute of limitations. I mean, suppose that 12 days after receiving the judgment in district court, you file a motion under Rule 60 or something, motion under Rule 60 for reconsideration by the judge. And the judge says to you, well, you know, I'll look at it very carefully. That doesn't toll your 30-day period for appealing.
No, I understand that. But the problem is that IFA... Mr. Brademas could reasonably rely that IFA would give him a fair shake.
Sure, but that's true if you file a Rule 60B motion. You say, you know, you want the judge to vacate the judgment, and he'll give it a fair consideration. He may even tell you he'll give it a fair consideration, but that doesn't toll your 30 days to appeal. Otherwise, statute of limitations would be meaningless. You just ask to reconsider, and they turn you down. You ask them again, and they say, well, all right, you want us to take a look at it again? We'll take a look at it again.
But the 8823 report to the Internal Revenue Code was never denominated as a final determination of IFA. In fact, because IFA was willing to look at that and receive more information.
No, that's not true. You yourself characterized Brademas' subsequent pleas or filings, whatever you want, as reconsideration. You don't ask for reconsideration until you've suffered an adverse decision. Otherwise, nothing reconsidered. This was not interlocutory. This was IFA's decision. He could try to get them to change their mind, but that's asking a court or an agency to reconsider its decision. And it's the decision that you have to appeal from.
Except that IFA is not a judicial body.
No, no, it's administrative, but it's the same thing. I mean, look, if your employer tells you you're fired, you can ask them to reconsider, but it's the firing that starts your, statute of limitations for employment discrimination suit running.
I need to answer that by saying that Mr. Bradamus could not determine if, in fact, he had been harmed for two reasons.
That's a separate point. That's
okay.
Your point about accrual. But you started off with the equitable tolling, equitable estoppel.
Correct.
How many notices of cure did Mr. Bradamus receive, Mr. Worthen?
Notices from IFA that you need to do something more to satisfy us about apartment 102?
Yeah. Right.
There were, I can't give you an exact number, but probably two or three before in the 1997 time frame. And then when IFA wasn't satisfied, Mr. Bradamus asked for the internal review, and he was led to believe they would do it, and he assembled more information.
Now, Madison's not a party to this lawsuit, is it?
That is correct. But
so what is Bradamus standing to challenge the IFA action?
Because the denial was for... They used the Madison apartment presumed or alleged noncompliance about Mr. Himes as grounds to basically taint the other seven who are plaintiffs in this case, because under the qualified allocation plan, if an applicant is in noncompliance with an unrelated entity, IFA can use that for these entities, and that's exactly what IFA did, notwithstanding the fact that we contend that Apartment 102 and Mr. Himes was always in compliance, and substantial information was given for that point. But just because IFA issues an 8832 notice to IRS doesn't mean that that's a final act giving an accrual of a cause of action. As a matter of fact, the attorney...
Well, what does it lack in the way of finality?
For one thing, the Internal Revenue Code is replete with ways to go back and amend or modify.
Look,
or
okay, but then we're back to the point. Whenever an agency, a court, anything, issues a decision, there's always inherent power to reconsider. That doesn't detract from its finality.
Well,
this is not an interlocutory. I mean, it's not that if you had done nothing, if you hadn't asked for reconsideration, would IFA have had to do something else in order to deny your tax credit?
It's unlikely, because IFA, if not being challenged by Mr. Bradamus, would have...
Of course, so that it was in other words, it's final.
Well...
Yeah, see, I think the problem is you want to argue the impact of the decision didn't occur until May of 99 when he lost financing. I mean, that was the impact of the decision. I think there's a distinction between impact and accrual, because the accrual was when when they made their ruling in June of 97. But the impact, there was no adverse consequence at the time. The adverse consequence was two years later, and I think you have a problem there when you look at what our law is on that, because I think we make a distinction between when the accrual occurred and when the impact of the decision was made. Maybe you could speak to that. How do you...
The cases relied upon by IFA arise out of employment discrimination cases, not 1983 claims. The Cotta case dealing with an early May notice that we're terminating you, and an end of May, that's when you're actually out the door. I can understand that the early May date is the date that the cause of action accrued for alleged employment discrimination. In this case, all you have is a notice to the Internal Revenue Code saying there's noncompliance, therefore...
But Bradamus knew immediately that if he didn't do anything about it, and Judge Williams put it, if he didn't do anything about it, there would be an impact. There would be a negative impact. He had to do something about it. He knew it was like being told he was
Except for...
Employment would terminate.
Except for one point. IFA could have said, we are not going to review it, and then he would have known he had no further recourse with IFA.
Well, that's the reconsideration issue.
I understand that, but...
It's no different from with the employer. The employer tells you, you're fired as of January 1st, and you say to the employer, look, wouldn't you reconsider that? The employer says, you know, I'd be happy to reconsider it, but still, that's not going to toll the statute of limitations because he's, you know, giving you your notice.
I agree in an employment termination.
But is that identical to this case?
It is not identical, Your Honor. It's not identical because what we have is we have a notice sent to the Internal Revenue Code. Those notices, the Internal Revenue Code modifies findings all the time based upon reviews and resubmissions. Frankly, Mr. Bradamus, I submit to you, when he asked for the review and they said, yes, we'll give you the review, and they wrote him October 29th, 1998, giving him an update on the status of it, I mean, why would Mr. Bradamus want to file suit if presumably IFA is acting in good faith?
Well, you think his lawyer would advise him that there's a 2-year statute of limitations.
And then it wasn't like a situation where IFA said, we have this thing under review, so we're going to notify the IRS not to do anything until we do our reconsideration. You know, that wasn't in the letter when they said they would review it. Then maybe he could say, you know, well, you know, I thought that IFA was going to let IRS know or pull it back or withdraw it, but they never took any position. They didn't withdraw anything from IRS, and that's where the problem is. Once IRS is in the game, unless there's some withdrawal by IFA.
Well, I understand your point, but frankly, in the real world, when you try to work with an administrative agency and they lead you to believe that they're going to undertake a good faith review, and if Mr. Bradamus goes along with that, why would he want to file suit, for one thing?
Well, so he doesn't kiss away his cause of action, well, because there's a 2-year statute of limit. Didn't he have a lawyer?
I can't, I'm sure...
There's a lot of money involved.
No, I understand, and I'm sure that he had some counsel then. I don't know if he used that counsel in 1997 or 1998, but frankly, whether he did or whether he didn't, I think... a primary issue is, could Mr. Bradamus reasonably rely upon IFA that he wouldn't need to do anything other than to cooperate with the review? And I think that, basically, the cases I've cited show that you don't need active wrongful conduct, you don't need concealment to show tolling or even equitable estoppel. All you need to do is show reasonable reliance. Frankly, Mr. Bradamus thought we're on the same page. They're going to review it. They're going to correct
you. You received an insurance notice from your auto liability carrier, Mr. Wertheimer. They're going to cancel you at the end of the next 30 days because that's when your policy is up. And you've had a 10-year relationship with them. Mm-hmm. You write to them or phone them and say to them, would you reconsider that decision? Would it be responsible not to back up that with you're getting another policy 30 days hence to make sure you can continue to drive? I mean, it's a sophisticated financial scheme. You had to know the financing was in jeopardy, right, when IFA took its action. I mean, this isn't extended credit at Mom and Pop's grocery store. I mean, this is a little heavier piece of commercial litigation potential.
I agree, and if I received an insurance notice, that's under contract, however.
Yeah.
And I would have to comply with the contract
right
within the 30 days. In this particular situation, however, rather than simply going out and filing suit, if the agency indicates, yes, we'll work with you and we'll review it, and they presumably work together to do it, isn't Mr. Bradamus entitled to rely upon that?
And so if we rule the way you're suggesting, that would be very problematic, that the only standard would be that we'll review, and that stops it.
No, I think
it's... statute. I mean, that's really what you're saying.
No.
You want us to say, because we are saying that we're going to review it, that's going to stop the clock.
No, it doesn't stop the clock in all instances, but in this particular instance, was Mr. Bradamus able to reasonably rely upon the actions of IFA such that there would be an equitable
How
argument?
How high a level an individual at IFA made the commitment to review? I mean, is there some line reviewer? Is our law going to base it on the luck of who Mr. Bradamus reaches at the other end of the phone at IFA? I mean, what?
No, not at all. But you have to understand that even though the 8823 notice was sent to the Internal Revenue Code, nothing else was in place. The developer, the financing end of it, he was working on it. And I frankly submit to you, Mr. Bradamus could reasonably...
But that wasn't the question. The question is, at what level in IFA was he told that they would reconsider?
At a high level, and the letter is from a senior official of IFA, the October 29th letter.
Wouldn't it make sense for Bradamus to have said to IFA, look, I'd like to work this out. I certainly don't want to bring a lawsuit. It may take a while to work it out. Will you make a deal with me that you will waive the statute of limitations for some reasonable period to allow us to work it out without my losing my right to sue? That's a conventional type of deal that people make when they hope to work things out, but they don't want, of course, to lose their rights.
With 20/20 hindsight, certainly that would be a prudent step to take. I would agree with you. But in the real world, I don't think people think about that when they're dealing with non-lawyers and they're all presumably acting in good faith for a common goal of correcting the mistake that was made about Mr. Himes in apartment 102. All IFA had to do was to say that we're not going to reconsider it, and then that would have been a red flag. But when IFA said we will reconsider it, and further exchanges happened, and then the delay, and as a matter of fact, Melanie Ruse, I hope I pronounced her name correctly, apologized basically that because of a change in staff they couldn't complete the file review. That's the end of October of 98.
Well, that's really my point, is what I'm right. I mean, if we're going to give any teeth to the statute, is it going to depend on some entry-level individual at IFA or this changing jobs to go work at another state agency? I mean, can you see the mushiness of this of the parameters that you're suggesting?
There's a presumption that the person signing on behalf of IFA has authority to do so. So it's within the scope of Melanie Ruse's job. And she makes certain statements and representations, even mentions that we're going to charge a fee after we're done.
What's Mr. Bradamus' financial background? I mean, what business was he in before he got into being the general partner of Madison Partnership? Have we got a sophisticated businessman here?
He is sophisticated. He was a teacher. He was involved in real estate. And then he got involved in these types of projects in the decade of the 80s. And I don't think that most real estate investors or persons dealing with real estates and projects get involved in these types of issues, the tax-exempt bond issues and tax credits and that sort of thing. But the degree of sophistication doesn't mean that Mr. Bradamus should have done anything differently than what he did, because again, I respectfully submit that what happened here shows that there should be a tolling.
What's your strongest case factually in any area of law that would speak to, in your judgment, our considering tolling?
Okay. Well, we haven't addressed the issue of the unity of the cause of action and the injury, but we probably...
Well, if it's in your brief, I'll find it. We're way over time.
I understand. I beg your pardon.
No, that's all right. I don't want to cut you off, but I thought you might have had to cite it handy.
No, it's in the brief.
Okay.
Okay.
Very good.
Statement's
worth on it.
Certainly.
Mr. Arnold?
Thank you. Simply, Judge McKinney at the district court got it right. He understood that two things happened. One, Madison, the Housing Finance Authority, determined and found that Madison Apartments failed to comply with the dictates of Section 42 for many, many more reasons than failure of apartment 102. Inadequate documentation, failure to comply with Section 42, poor records, and just a simple decline to comply or to bring one unit into compliance. As a result of that, IRS was notified. That's all it is. 8823 notifies IRS of this default, of this problem. And then IFA, as it does every tax credit recipient, finds noncompliance, it works with them to try to bring the project back into compliance with Section 42, which, one, helps save tax credit for people like Mr. Bradamus, the money that he has made on that, and number two, it helps ensure that there's affordable housing continues to be offered to the community, as intended by statute. That's one thing that happened. The second thing that happened is that because of Madison's egregious noncompliance,
how egregious?
Inadequate documentation going back 10 years, a simple, not a refuse, or not a failure to bring 102 into compliance, they just said they weren't going to.
So their position on reconsideration was you just made a mistake? That there was nothing to bring into compliance?
Well, there was many things. They agreed there was many things they needed to do to bring it into compliance, and they tried to do that. This is part of the overall Section 42 program.
I thought you said they did nothing.
Well, they didn't make it all the way, and they still haven't. They tried to do some things. They brought some of the documentation up, but section or this apartment 102 is almost a comedy because at that point, you know, they declined to bring it up. They said, we're not going to bring it into compliance. We're going to let somebody that's not qualified continue to live there. So with that kind of a situation with Madison, we get an application for four, five, six other projects, and the Housing Authority said no. They declined. In February of 97, they said no. And thereafter, what happened? The Housing Authority continued as part of the Qualified Allocation Plan, as part of Section 42 the code requires, as part of its policies and practices, continued to work with Mr. Bradamus to bring Madison back into compliance. That's what happened. There was efforts to comply, and that's good. And some of the things were brought up to date. We don't know what IRS did with that, but it's from our standpoint, some of the things brought up to date. There's no factual dispute as to what happened here. What happened and when it happened. What happened? A finding of noncompliance. And they were told there was noncompliance. When? In February of 97. What happened? In February of 97, they were told that their new applications were declined. And what did they do after that? They did one, as Judge McKinney noted, they tried to bring Madison into compliance, and two, rather than follow an appellate process, whatever, or file suit, as Judge McKinney says, they elected the political avenue to try to bring political pressure to, you know, to change the decision. IFA did nothing other than what it does pursuant to the Qualified Allocation Plan, pursuant to Section 42 of the Code, to bring Madison into compliance. It was clear. And when they either declined, their new applications were declined, the answer was simply no. They could have applied again. They never have. But none, continuing to work to bring a project into compliance with Section 42, as with Madison, that's not tolling the statute of limitations. That's not deceit. That's not sandbagging. And that's not misleading. Judge McKinney got it right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. The case is taken under advisement.